Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Wednesday, September 13th, 2023. And on this episode, I'm going to share with you an overview of the founders' position and warnings against standing armies, which are generally defined as large, permanent, professional military establishments. And more importantly, where it really came from, why they held this position. And I think first it's important to note that the American colonists didn't make this up out of thin air. They actually came from a long English tradition of opposition to standing armies in times of peace. And two of the most influential writings on this, on the founders on this, were from a guy named John Trenchard, who also co-authored the Cato's Letters in the early 18th century. The stuff that he wrote on this was very, very widely read in the colonies. One of them was called An Argument Showing That a Standing Army is Inconsistent with a Free Government. That's in 1697. I'm not covering that one today, but I also want to point out this one, A Short History of Standing Armies in England. And he kicks it off by calling standing armies slavery. He said, if any man doubts whether a standing army is slavery, et cetera, goes through a few examples why that's absurd. That to doubt that view, because everyone understands that a standing army is slavery. And then he goes on with this. The first footsteps I find of a standing army in England since the Romans left the island were in Richard II's time. And if I've got my dates right, that means from the Romans to the end of the 14th century, there was really no standing army in times of peace. And then he continues with this. The nation had, once they had that standing army for a short time, it was awful. And he said the nation had such a specimen of this reign, in this reign of a standing army, that I do not find any king from him to Charles I that attempted keeping up any forces in times of peace, except the yeomen of the guard, who were constituted by Henry VII. So again, another two centuries, because I think that was, we're pushing towards around 1600. And standing opposition to standing armies was such a big deal in England through these centuries that they actually ended up getting opposition to it included in the English Bill of Rights in 1689, which few people actually cite, but very, very important stuff. And here's how they put it, that the raising or keeping a standing army within the kingdom in time of peace, unless it be with consent of Parliament, is against law. Now, Trenchard saw that as kind of a half measure because, well, he's talking about here in this history that they originally had 28 articles, but it was whittled down. We see this happen with politicians and committees and things like that. It ended up being whittled down to 13 articles. But he said the most considerable, so the most important was the one about standing armies. He said the most considerable, that the raising and keeping up a standing army in times of peace is contrary to law. So that's what it was originally. That was the proposal. But during the process, they watered it down and they had tagged to it these words, without authority of Parliament. And Trenchard says, as if the consent of the Parliament would not have made it legal without those words, or that their consent would make it less dangerous. So it was just widely understood that this was bad stuff. Now, another important, influential piece of writing to the founders was in 1722, Thomas Gordon, who was the other part of Cato's Letters, he published a discourse on standing armies. And T.J. Martinell summarized it. I'm just going to give this four main points. One, tyranny is an illegitimate response to the threat of tyranny. Again, this was what the founders and the revolutionaries all read. They were very much influenced by this. Two, permanent armies are essentially for establishing and maintaining tyranny. Three, the necessity, and of course, they're always telling us that these things are needed for our security or whatever, the necessity for a permanent army doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And four, governments use a never-ending list of excuses to maintain a permanent army. Now, go fast forward to the time of ratification. I'm going to cover the revolution, some of the things that happened during the revolution in a bit. But if we fast forward to the time of ratification, basically everyone, Federalists and Anti-Federalists alike, saw standing armies as dangerous to the liberties of the people. They all saw it as dangerous. The debate was not over that. Everyone agreed. There really isn't. I can't even find an outlier. It's like, no, this is cool, no problem. And I'm going to get to even Hamilton, who agreed with the Anti-Federalists that standing armies were dangerous. They all were on board with that message. It was just how to deal with it. And here from gradesaver.com, this is not a site I've ever referenced, but this is actually a pretty decent overview, minus some, I guess, semantic issues. The Anti-Federalists viewed the national government, it should be general government's power. I'm not going to get through all the details of that, but the Anti-Federalists viewed the power to raise and command a standing army in peacetime and to exert control over state militias as a dangerous step in the direction of arbitrary monarchical government. Of course, we know Thomas Paine's Common Sense was a huge hit in January 1776, and that was railing against the idea of a hereditary monarchy and the type of power that they could wield. Arbitrary power, that's power that they're not authorized to exercise in the first place. This is one of the grievances, we'll call them for now, in the Declaration of Independence. But going further, like their English predecessors, the Anti-Federalists saw standing armies as a source of moral corruption that would weaken the spirit of independence and liberty that was the foundation of America's martial strength. A couple of examples from the Anti-Federalists. Here's one. A Democratic Federalist in October 1787 said the experience of past ages and the result of the inquiries of the best and most celebrated patriots have taught us to dread a standing army above all earthly evils. This was not something that got this writer ridiculed because it was so out there. This was a widely held view that a standing army is to be dreaded above all earthly evils. George Mason jumped in with this. When once a standing army is established in any country, the people lose their liberty. Some people will tell us, standing armies are only dangerous with kings or bad politicians or people with too much power. But Mason warned that any country, any system, anywhere, anytime, as soon as they have a standing army, that is, a permanent military establishment, even in times of peace, the people are going to lose their liberty. Back to Grade Saver, in case you're trying to improve your grades. They're talking about the Federalist response, and I think this applies really to Federalists in general, not just the Federalist paper. They say they do not depart from these traditional fears expressed by the Anti-Federalists. Again, the Federalist side did not debate the Anti-Federalists that about standing armies not being dangerous. They just agreed. And they point out that rather than question the Anti-Federalist fear of standing armies, they leveraged it in defense of a political structure that would reduce the need for such forces and, to the extent they must exist, prevent them from threatening American liberty. So on the one side, they're basically saying no one should be not everyone. Of course, it's not universal that they had the same approach. But the Anti-Federalist view is basically this is bad. Don't allow them to do this. Or if you're going to, keep it very small, be very specific what they can do and how much they can have. On the other side, they're saying, well, we need to have this because there could be unforeseen circumstances. But why don't we do something that can basically prevent the need to call a standing army, to raise a standing army? And James Madison may have summed that up best. He said, as the greatest danger to liberty is from large standing armies, it is best to prevent them by an effectual provision for a good militia. This is a serious statement in support of the right to keep and bear arms by the people, and not just hunting rifles or sport shooting, but military-grade weapons. Tench Cox, of course, told us that the weapons of the soldier is the birthright of every one of us. And so Madison is saying, you really arm up the people, and then you don't really need a standing army. It's just, there's no point in it. And even Alexander Hamilton took a very similar approach. Here in Federalist Number 8, November 20th, 1787, he said, the violent destruction of life and property incident to war, the continual effort and alarm attendant on a state of continual danger, will compel nations the most attached to liberty to resort for repose and security to institutions which have a tendency to destroy their civil and political rights. That's a long take of saying trading liberty for security. Of course, I think that's a nonsense argument. That's the argument of tyrants. There is no liberty or security debate. You can only have freedom and liberty. You can only have safety when we're actually free. That's how I'm supposed to put it. I should know this one by now. But that's what Hamilton's pointing out. I'm not sure if he agreed with that approach, but he's recognizing this is what people and nations do. They tend, even if you're the most attached to liberty, under threats of war or fear of danger, things like that. Of course, John Adams in 1776 said fear is the foundation of most governments. So when people are afraid, they go to government and say, hey, arm up and protect us. That's what he says. Hamilton says, to be more safe, they at length become willing to run the risk of being less free. And what is he referring to? The institutions chiefly alluded to are standing armies. Those of you who are watching, you can see that he put standing armies in all caps. He's really emphasizing this. And the correspondent appendages of military establishments. So he's basically saying, yes, I absolutely agree with the anti-federalists, because what he's writing about is generally a debate with various anti-federalists in these papers. I agree. Standing armies are very dangerous. But if you don't ratify, you're going to end up with a dissolution of the Confederacy. And because of that, we're going to have all these independent states, and they're all going to have their own standing armies. So if you oppose standing armies, ratify. Because we only have the chance of having one standing army instead of maybe a dozen or so of them. So it's an interesting take. But I can see how people at the time might be considering these options. Look, of course, it's primary on almost everyone's mind that standing armies are dangerous. And everyone agrees with this. It's just the approach that Federalists and Anti-Federalists, how to deal with that. That's where they differ. And I should point out that I will, in the next couple of hours, and Alan Mosley is putting together all the blog posts these days, doing an awesome job, giving me some extra time to do some other stuff, put together some short videos and things like that. But we publish a blog post for every single episode over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty a couple hours after the live stream is done. And there you're going to find all the different platforms we're on, both video and audio platforms, plus a show link section where you're going to see all the stuff that I'm mentioning here. Hey, where's that Trenchard thing? Or where's that Hamilton essay or Madison, etc.? Well, you're going to find it all in the show links section for the blog post for this episode over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. That way, instead of just hearing small quotes, you can read it all in context on your own time and really ramp up your, I guess, your grades. Anyways, let's get right back to it. I got a lot of ground to cover, and I'm still experiencing some construction here this week, so I do have to head out as early as I can today to deal with a few things. But anyways, back to T.J. Martinell talking about Gordon's, the other part of Cato's letters, his take on standing armies as well. This is an article called Using Tyranny to Prevent Tyranny, a Warning on Standing Armies. Of course, that will be linked to in the show notes. And TJ says, one of the forgotten values of the American founders was their deeply held opposition to a permanent standing army. And I don't think we even have to say permanent, because standing armies, it was understood, were there. They were standing in times of peace. This was born of experience. Not only did they have that long tradition, all the history that they had read, all the people that they had learned from had warned against standing armies, but they also lived it firsthand. The stuff that they were warned about, they went through it. So then they were even more opposed to standing armies, I think, than at the beginning. Again, this was born of experience. In late 1763, at the end of the French and Indian War, which was just in the colonies, a part, just a theater of a truly global war, a world war called the Seven Years' War, the British decided to station 10,000 troops for protection. This is something that they hadn't been doing. And all of a sudden, you finally get peace, and now you're going to have this permanent garrison of thousands of troops, and that's expensive. And of course, the war was expensive. And to keep many of the troops from being out of work, John Adams wrote, he was not happy about it. He said, revenue is still demanded from America and appropriated to the maintenance of swarms of officers and pensioners and in idleness and luxury. Swarms of officers. You may have heard a similar phrase used in the Declaration of Independence as well. TJ says, by 1770, concerns over the standing armies became reality. I think they were even before that, but when the occupying British army resulted in the massacre in Boston, that sure brought it out firsthand, without a doubt. Now, James Madison, I cite him all the time at Political Observations in 1795. I think he explained the American experience on this in some detail pretty well. And of course, he said, war, of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. This is what the American revolutionaries lived under. This is what they learned would happen. They saw it happen firsthand. Their friends, their loved ones were killed, were dominated by the standing army. So if you think about what James Madison had to say in the context of the American Revolution, that is the radical change in the views of the people from 1760-61 until the shots were fired in April of 1775, we can easily see what Madison was talking about. First, of course, there was that long tradition, the English tradition, of opposition to standing armies in times of peace. But then we have the Seven Years' War. So you have a war that becomes very expensive. As a result of the war, the excuse of the people in power is that now you need a standing army, and then you have to pay for that as well. But during the war, even before you get to the debts and taxes part of it, we also have mass warrantless surveillance. General warrants is what they were called, under the writs of assistance, so they could search any home. And the reason that they implemented these was because they wanted to collect revenue to pay for the war, and they wanted to prevent people from trading with the enemy, the French West Indies. And so this was a wartime measure, the writs of assistance. John Adams, when he described James Otis Jr.'s multi-hour, 4 or 5 hour speech against the writs of assistance in 1761, John Adams described it years later as, then and there the child independence was born. So war gave us mass surveillance, general warrants. Otis said acts against the Constitution are void, talking about the writs of assistance, this general warrant program. And that was the beginning of the controversy between the colonies and Great Britain. It came out of war, and, well, then we get the standing armies. So then from there, of course, once you get peace, people are thinking, okay, cool, everything's going to go back to normal. But instead, the British stationed this pretty significant permanent standing army for their protection. And they needed to raise money to pay for it, plus the debts from the war. So they gave the colonists things like the Sugar Act of 1764, the Stamp Act of 1765, which had massive resistance to it. And when they resisted, and Murray Rothbard called it the People's Nullification of the Stamp Act, while they repealed it because of that nullification, the resistance, the opposition, the nullification efforts, the noncompliance, they passed the Declaratory Act, I believe the same day that they repealed it in 1766, claiming power over the colonies in all cases whatsoever. Unlimited power. Thomas Paine said that kind of power only belongs to God. No one on earth can have that kind of power. So they use this and some of the examples. And John Hancock said, you know, taxation without representation is only an example of this claimed power over us in all cases whatsoever. And of course, they were doing all of these things as a result of war and the permanent standing army. So we also had the Townshend Acts of 1767. Opposition to that gave them more troops. And I'm not sure if they increased the troops or they just started to really kind of circle them with that. And then we had the massacre in Boston. And then they tried the Tea Act to raise money again to pay for all this stuff, which led to the Tea Party, which led to the Coercive Acts, or the Intolerable Acts, some people will still call them, which, of course, led to more resistance. And then the British, in response to that, you can see how it just keeps ramping up. And this is what empires always do. They never recognize that they're going to crumble if they don't back off. They all, and Benjamin Franklin said, empires, like individuals, you know, they falter from either pride or folly. I think that's how he described it as well. So the British then ramped it up in response to resistance to the Coercive Acts. They said, we have to stop these people from trying to be free and doing what they want to do. And so they implemented a gun control program, banning importation of arms and ammunition without a permit. They don't issue permits. And then they try to confiscate stuff. They send troops in September of 1774 to collect gunpowder. Luckily, the people had already gotten their own out of the storehouse. But it happened again, of course. More gun control and regular troops implementing the gun control in April of 1775. And that's where we get the shot heard around the world. The rest is history. And of course, this was also included. This idea of standing armies, this opposition to standing armies, was even included in the Declaration of Independence. I know most people call them grievances. I did earlier here on this show. But they were actually cited in the Declaration as injuries and usurpations. So attacks on the people, their liberty, and usurpations, exercises of power that they were never authorized to do. And here's what it says. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. So if you're going to have a standing army, it's only going to be the consent of the people more locally, similar to what they put in the English Bill of Rights. John Trenchard wasn't happy with that, but it's rather than having one person implement that and having it be nationally or everywhere, they're saying, look, you can't, this is a serious injury and usurpation of power. And it's listed in the Declaration of Independence. So it's a pretty big deal. So I think Madison really, really hammered home what happened through the Revolution and why this experience really firmed up this opposition to standing armies. And we even have people like General George Washington, the head of the Continental Army. This guy disbanded the army as soon as there was peace. He did the opposite of what the British did. Some people wanted him to be a king. I'm sure Hamilton did. Some people thought or warned that if you didn't ratify the Constitution, Washington was going to ride in and force it down their throats. We heard that argument before as well. But here, on November 4th, 1783, General Washington issued a proclamation officially disbanding the Continental Army. This was after the Treaty of Paris, just previous to that. 1783, it's officially done, even though the fighting had been pretty much over before that. But it's officially done, and rather than garrisoning troops for your safety and then having debts and taxes to pay for it, Washington says, go home. Go home. It's over. He said, I do hereby give this public notice that from and after the 15th day of this instant November, all troops within the above description shall be considered as discharged from the service of the United States. And all officers commanding corps or detachments of any such troops are hereby directed to grant them proper discharges accordingly. Now, they did keep a token number of troops. It says here from Rob Collection, I think it's a history website, a token number of troops remained afterwards to maintain order, complete enlistment obligations, or because they were ill or needed to care for the sick. But a few weeks later, in early December, General Washington ordered General Henry Knox to discharge even these men, except for 500 infantry and 100 artillerymen. So basically keeping a tiny force. This is pretty much the Federalist approach. No large standing army, maybe a small force to be able to respond to a few things here and there. This was primarily a frontier type of thing. I'm not sure if they would have had a similar view today. I can't really make that determination, but they were saying we should protect the frontier with a few hundred, and that's it. And everybody else goes home. And Washington took that view some months earlier, before the Treaty of Paris. This is May 1st, 1783, his sentiments on a peace establishment. And here he is again, pointing out that a standing army is dangerous to liberty. He said, although a large standing army in time of peace has ever been considered dangerous to the liberties of a country, yet a few troops under certain circumstances are not only safe, but indispensably necessary. And again, this is the Federalist take some years later during ratification. Look, you ought not to have a standing army in time of peace, but if you do have it, keep it very, very small because it's always dangerous and it might get out of hand. Now, the anti-Federalists, I think, were more concerned about human nature. And they weren't as comfortable with the checks and balances, so they were concerned that as soon as you give anybody this power, it would be abused. Now, you can determine for yourself who you think was correct on that one, but that's, I think, another take for another day. But Washington wasn't alone. Here's General Washington saying, large standing armies in times of peace are dangerous to the liberties of the people. What about the first Secretary of War? That's what they used to call it, not Secretary of Defense. The first Secretary of War under George Washington, also a senior general of the Continental Army, that is Henry Knox. And here's how he put it in January of 1790. This was a plan for an arrangement of the militia. He's taking the position that standing armies are very dangerous. Let's have a really strong militia so the people can defend themselves and we don't have to rely on this professional establishment, which is destructive to liberty. He said, the modern practice of Europe with respect to the employment of standing armies has created such a mass of opinion in their favor that even philosophers and the advocates for liberty have frequently confessed their use and necessity in certain cases. So he's pointing out, like, look, it's so common, and we have much more today, so common in 1790 that they're mistakenly saying, this is cool. It's all right. He said, but whoever seriously and candidly, I'll try this again. Again, General Henry Knox. But whoever seriously and candidly estimates the power of discipline and the tendency of military habits will be constrained to confess that whatever may be the efficacy of a standing army in war, it cannot in peace be considered as friendly to the rights of human nature. I mean, this is a man of war, literally senior general of the Continental Army. The victors in the War for Independence, the first Secretary of War under former General George Washington. And he's also saying, no way, no matter what anybody tells you, having these establishments in times of peace are not friendly to the rights of human nature. He said, an energetic national militia is to be regarded as the capital security of a free republic and not a standing army forming a distinct class within the community. Well, I hope you guys found this interesting. I hope it was educational. I hope it made you think. I hope you learned something. I hope you enjoy this information as much as I enjoyed sharing it with you. If you support this type of work that we're doing, you want to help us reach and teach more people about these essential founding principles, absolutely nothing helps us roll up our sleeves every single day and do this kind of work more than the financial faith and support of our members. If you got a couple of bucks of that dirty government fiat, throw it our way. Over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members, nobody punches above their weight class better than the 10th Amendment Center. And while I'm here, I do want to say a quick thank you, a huge thank you, express my gratitude to just a handful of people who have joined us as members lately. Again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. There's Jeffrey in Michigan, Michael, awesome name in Georgia, Kenneth in Texas, Krista in Texas, two Texas, and Henry in my former home of Wisconsin. I appreciate all of you and everyone that I didn't mention, and I appreciate you watching the show. Again, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed putting together this information to share with you, and I hope to see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.